Good you're here. I'm glad you come to study. Let's jump into that. We started last week, and I've got lesson number one on there. That's an oversight on my fault. That's lesson number two. We dealt with some introductory material last week, and we're going to continue that and get into the kings themselves today. Last week, we began our study by looking at the establishment of the Israeli nation, of how God called them out of Egypt and made and how he made a covenant with them. Now, that covenant, the second part we looked at there was how that covenant was really something that went back to Genesis 12 with Abraham, and how all that he did with them was really founded on that covenant. And then finally, we were looking how God then, following the death of Moses and then Joshua, God's ultimate plan was to establish judges over the nation of Israel. And that's where we're going to pick up in this study tonight. We'll continue looking at the establishment of those judges and how that led into their cry for a king. And how ultimately that was a rejection of God. And then God's going to give them a warning, a very prophetic warning, about what's going to happen as a result of their cry for a king. We'll talk more about that. And then hopefully tonight we'll be able to get into looking at Saul being selected as the first king. So let's go ahead and pick up where we left off. Let's go to Joshua 23. And that's where we'll get started. So as I mentioned before, so first you have Moses as the chosen leader of Israel. Moses is the man who leads them out of Egypt through the power of God, and then he's the man who leads them through the wilderness. Now, of course, the first time they come to the land of promise, they're not that generation was so corrupt that God said, you know what, you're going to have to go back and wander through the wilderness. That whole generation dies, and then it's that second generation that actually enters the promised land. What's fascinating, only two of that first generation lived to make it into the promised land. Who were the two?
Joshua and Caleb.
Not even Moses or Aaron or any of them. They all die in the wilderness wanderings. And so finally it's Joshua who takes them across the River Jordan, and how in doing that God is, of course, delivering on that promise to Abraham about this land. And so Joshua, of course, takes them through. They then begin to defeat all these other nations. They have some stumbles along the way, but eventually they take possession of the land. Now, as I was talking to the boys last night, Lisa and I were about, there was a problem that occurred. Do you remember what it was? Did they do completely what God wanted them to do?
No.
No. There were several times where they chose to not utterly drive out the inhabitants of the land. There's several times when that occurs. The Benjamites don't drive out the Amalekites out of Jerusalem. And then you have some that were living in the hills that get left. What's the ultimate problem with all that? It eventually is going to lead them into idolatry. And so we'll look more at that as we get into the kings. But that's a backstory that we need to remember, right? That plays into the history of Israel in a big way. Because, you know, they failed to drive out sinful influence. They were influenced later and they go into sin. You know, there's an obvious lesson. Here's a devotional lesson for you. They don't drive out the sinful influence in their life, which eventually comes back to bite them, and they end up in sin. Same thing is true with us. We don't drive out sinful influence. What's eventually going to happen? You know, if I refuse to stop looking with my eyes at things I shouldn't look at, eventually what's going to happen? That's going to influence me. If I stop listening to things that bring on evil influences, what's eventually going to happen? I'm going to be influenced by it. And the same thing is true with them. And so Joshua leads them to the land. And they do a pretty good job, but they don't fully do what God's asked them to do. And there's an interesting dialogue in Joshua, starts in Joshua 23, and I want to take us through that for a little bit here. So Joshua 23, 2 and 3, Joshua summoned all Israel, and summoned all Israel, its elders and heads, its judges and officers, and said to them, "I am now old and well advanced in years, and you have seen all that the Lord your God has done to all these nations for your sake. For it is the Lord your God who has fought for you." Right? So he establishes a reality, right? The reality is I'm getting old. Joshua can see the end, right? And I think Joshua is really afraid, not for his own being, but for what he knows is a possibility, that they will succumb to the pressure of sin and they'll give in to it. And so he's concerned about that. And so what does he begin by doing? What's the first thing he does? He reminds them of what God's already done for them. Right? So you notice what he's doing. He's making them look backwards. Looking backwards can be of a benefit, right? Don't we all need to take looks backwards sometime? Now, we can't get fixated on the backwards, but we need to learn from it. And that's his point. So he says, "The Lord who's fought for you." Go down to verse 5. And I'm going to go through this kind of quickly. If you have a question, you can stop me. But I want to drive toward a point here. "The Lord your God will push back them before you and drive them out of your sight. And you shall possess their land just as the Lord your God promised you." All right? So God has provided on that promise. Go down to verses 6 through 8. It says, "Therefore," now with all that in mind, with what God's done for you, how he's fulfilled his promise for you, "therefore." So, therefore is what? In conclusion, right? Or, with all that we've talked about, this is how we apply it. So it says, "Therefore, be very strong to keep and to do all that is written in the book of law, in the book of the law of Moses, turning aside from it neither to the right hand nor to the left, that you may not mix with these nations remaining among you." Well, let's see, that underline that little phrase right there, because that's important. They shouldn't be there. You allowed them to remain. But now they're there. Right? We all have problems in our lives. Things we should have dealt with long ago, but they're there. And so he says, "I want to remind you of that. Remaining among you, and make mention of the names of their that you may not mix with these nations remaining among you, or make mention of the names of their gods, or swear by them, or serve them, or bow down to them. But you shall cling to the Lord your God, just as you have done to this day." And so that's really the crux of the matter for them. Will they choose idolatry, or will they choose to continue to serve God? Go down to verse 9. He goes on, he says, "For the Lord has driven out before you great and strong nations, just as for you no man has been able to stand before you to this day." Now, one thing I meant to put in here and I didn't, but there's a passage, I believe it's in Deuteronomy, where God talks about his choosing of Israel. And he mentions how he didn't choose them because they were strong, because they are a great number, because, you know, any of the things that humans make choices based on, right? It wasn't because they were a great nation, or a powerful nation, or a rich nation. God chose them because he loved them. So, when they look back at all the victories they've had, what's the one thing that stands out? God did all of those things. What was, they go through, they get into Jericho, they defeat Jericho, because they've done what God said, and God gave them Jericho. They go to Ai, and what happened? Or they defeat Ai, and then they go on to... No, I'm sorry, you're right. It's Ai. They go to Ai the first time. I should have trusted myself. They go to Ai. They're defeated in Ai. Why? Because God isn't with them in that battle, right? And they run fleeing. They flee from the people of Ai.
And it was a very special place.
Ites.
It says, such a small army. They didn't send a whole army. It's a bunch of army there.
And so they go running. I think 36 of them are killed. So they defeat this huge place of Jericho with God's help. They go to Ai, this much smaller place, this unfortified city, and they lose. Well, they go and they get things corrected. What happens the second time? They just utterly destroy Ai. So the point always is what? When you're in keeping with God, God will fight for you. And I love, you know, to go through and to think about all the times in Joshua where it says God fought for them, or God is fighting for them, or, you know, any kind of similar phrase, right? When God fights our battles with us, or for us, more accurately, we're going to win every time. When we go at it alone, we're going to lose. And so he says, God has driven out before you great and strong men. The implication there is stronger and bigger than you. That's the point he's trying to make. These great and strong nations are bigger than you, are stronger than you. But with me, with God on your side, you can defeat any of them. Going down to verse 11, he says, be very careful, therefore, to love the Lord your God. For if you turn back and cling to the remnant of these nations remaining among you and make marriages with them. Now, he's adding in second stipulation. I want you to notice this. We're going to come back to it. So, and make marriages with them so that you associate with them and they with you. Know for certain that the Lord your God will no longer drive out these nations before you. But they shall be a snare and a trap for you, a whip on your sides and thorns in your eyes. Ouch. Until you perish from off this good ground that the Lord your God has given you. Now you notice there are a few things. Now, just like when that first generation that came out of Egypt, what did they keep doing every time they weren't getting their way or felt like they deserved something? What do they always reflect back on? They always say, oh, things were so much better in Egypt. The food was so much better in Egypt. You probably say, you just give us bread from heaven. You know, this manna stuff, man, I remember when we used to have, you know, scallops and all these other things, right? And I'm paraphrasing, obviously. But what were they doing? They kept romanticizing an evil past. Right? They weren't appreciating what they had. We ever failed to appreciate what we have? You know, husbands and wives would do very well to appreciate what God's given them in their children and in their relationship. Instead of always focusing on what you don't have, focus on what God has given you. And for all of us, and so he says, don't cling to that. Don't cling to that. That cost that first generation their paradise. It could cost them too. And it can cost us. And then the second thing, you know, and make marriages with them. What's the significance of that? He only the translation of English Standard used that word cling, right, a little bit earlier. Cling to them. Well, what's more enigmatic of clinging to marriage? What does marriage do? You know, when a young man and a young lady get married, they're not just marrying each other, are they? Are you? You're marrying a whole group of people. Always be careful. Look a little further. Realize, young man, you're not just marrying her, you're going to marry her mother. You're going to marry her daddy. Young lady, you're not just marrying him, you're marrying a mother-in-law. Most likely, I know it's not always the case, but mother-in-law, father-in-law, you got a lot of cousins. You know, just look around. Make sure you know what you're getting yourself into. That's a little bit of a silly way to say it. But there is a reality to it, though, isn't there? Marriage binds us with people. And And it's going to be very tempting for the Israelites to bond themselves with these other people. Was God being mean when he said, don't marry the people? That seemed awful mean. Is that racist of God? Of course, the answer is no, but nobody's responding back. Why is God saying that?
He knows our nature.
He knows that young men are often drawn by their eyes, not always by their heads. Young ladies are drawn by their hearts, not always by their mind, but their head. He knows what marriage can do, right? And how it bonds you with things. I mean, there's so many examples. I mean, I go back to Genesis chapter 6, when the sons of God married the daughters of men. Now, that implication is not talking about angels, and we could get in a whole discussion about that. But what he's talking about, the sons of men marrying the daughters of men, what he's saying is you had these men who were sons of God who were taken down by the influence that they came under in these marriages. One of the things we try to promote with our boys, and I'm sure many of you do, is I'm like, make sure when you meet Mrs. Wright, after you get over the butterflies, go ahead and put those aside for a minute. Make sure the person you're marrying is somebody who's as dedicated to the Lord as you should be. Right? And you think about Genesis 6, you think about King Solomon, right? And all the evil influences. You think about, you know, and so many examples in the Bible and in our own lives of this thing. And so God is trying to say to them, do not, what does Paul say to the Corinthians? Do not be unequally yoked. It's the same principle, isn't it? So that's the warning. He's giving them a pretty strong warning. It says verse 14 and 15. Now therefore, fear the Lord and serve Him in sincerity and faithfulness. Put away the gods of your father, the gods that your father served beyond the river and in Egypt. Remember their influence on men. Put those away. And serve the Lord. And if it is evil in your eyes, and this famous verse that many homes have up on a wall somewhere, right? Because it is a beautiful principle, but it's a very real thing too. And Joshua was saying a deep truth here. And if it is evil or wrong in your eyes to serve the Lord, choose this day whom you will serve. Whether the gods your father served in the region beyond the river, or the gods of the Amorites in whose land you dwell. But as for me and my house, we will serve the Lord. And so that idea of they have to make a choice, it's a decision to serve God. And it is a daily decision that we make every day. And so he lays it out before them. It's the preacher giving his invitation. Now, how do they respond? Verses 16 through 18. Then the people answered, far be it from us that we should forsake the Lord to serve other gods. For it is the Lord our God who brought us and our fathers up from the land of Egypt, out of the house of slavery, and who did those great signs in our sight, and preserved us all the way that we went among all the peoples through whom we passed. And the Lord drove out before us all the peoples, the Amorites who lived in the land. Therefore, we also will serve the Lord, for He is our God. They're very decisive in this. We're going to serve God. We're making this pledge. We can do it. And we'll see how successful they are as time goes. I think this generation actually was pretty successful in that. We'll note that in a minute. But later on down the line, I don't know if that's necessarily the case. And so they respond in a very strong way. Far be it from us to serve anyone else. J. Joshua, I don't know if this is prophetic common sense or prophetic Holy Spirit inspiration, but he says in verse 19, Joshua said to the people, "You are not able to serve the Lord, for he is a holy God. He is a jealous God. He will not forgive your transgressions or your sins. If you forsake the Lord and serve foreign gods, then he will turn and do you harm and consume you after having done you good." Man, is that a negative way to respond? What is he trying to say to them? He says he won't forgive their sins and transgressions of sins. What does he mean by that?
God is not going to tolerate any deviation.
It's like the individual who Monday through Saturday lives like the world, right? They get into all the things the world gets into, and they show up on Sunday morning and they expect just to be accepted. Now, we can be forgiven by men, not forgiven by God. We can't live on the fence. We can't serve what Jesus says. You cannot serve mammon and God. Right, you've got to make a choice. And so his warning seems harsh, but it's a real thing, right? Does God forgive sin and transgression? Absolutely. He even forgave the Israelites over and over again. His point is you can't ask for forgiveness out of an insincere heart. You know, Mark 16:16, what does it say? The Great Commission statement of Mark. Alright, so why does he add that second remark? He says, he that believeth and is baptized shall be saved, but he that believeth not shall be condemned. Why add the second remark? Why isn't the first remark enough? You know, he that believeth and is baptized shall be saved. Why add that final remark?
You need to know the consequences of not believing.
Can somebody go through all the actions of obedience and not really believe? Yeah, they can, right? They can. They can do seemingly all the right things, but out of an evil heart, right? Just to do it for some kind of ulterior motive. I always think about Simon the sorcerer, right? When Peter when he's asking for the gifts of the Holy Spirit, what does Peter say to him? He wants to buy it with money. You have no part in this. Pray God that this evil would be forgiven you. I don't know if that's exactly the wording, but I know it's similar to that. You know, that the heart is important, right? The motivation. And so, in order to get God's forgiveness or to receive it, we must be properly motivated, not just do the right things, right? It's not enough just to come to worship and sing. Your singing needs to be motivated in the correct way. It's not enough just to come and drink the cup and take the bread, right? Isn't that what Paul's point is in 1 Corinthians 11:35? Let a man examine himself. Motivation is important. And just doing things only lasts so long. Eventually, you'll just quit. So we go on to verse 21, and I know I'm going on this, but I want to really set the foundation here. The people said to Joshua, so what's their response? Would you be a little offended? Maybe a little upset at what he said? He said, "No, you can't do this. Except for God is a holy God." What's their response? Verse 20, I'd be hurt. Right? That hurt my feelings a little bit when he said, "No, you can't do it." I'm like, really? Well, they are emphatic about responding back, right? They say, no, but we will serve the Lord. And Joshua said to the people, you are witnesses against yourselves that you have chosen the Lord to serve him. And they said, we are witnesses. And then you go down to verse 31. And like I said, you know, this generation is pretty emphatic about it. Well, actually, in Joshua, it's a pretty inspiring passage. You go to verse 31 of the chapter. Israel served the Lord all the days of Joshua. So all the time he lived. But notice this. All the days of Joshua and all the days of the elders who outlived Joshua and had known all the work that the Lord did for Israel. So you have the generation that with Joshua serving God in an upright way. God, I mean, the Bible definitively says they served him. Not only them, but the generation that came, that was there, that outlived Joshua. Judges lays it out for us as well. Judges chapter 2 and verse 10. The writer of Judges says, and all that generation also were gathered to their fathers. All right, and so, and I didn't have it up here, and I should have, but it makes mention of them serving God and then their children serving God. I should have had verse 9 up there. But then notice the end of verse 10. And there arose another generation after them. Notice how it characterizes them. Who did not know the Lord or the work that he had done for Israel. And that's the generation we're going to get into in this next section. Any questions about that particular section before I move on? I know it's kind of lengthy, but... All right, so now you have Joshua has moved on to his reward, and you kind of have a leadership vacuum in the human eyes. Now, we'll get into who the actual king of Israel was, but in their mind, they start to wonder, well, who's going to lead all of this? Go to Judges chapter 2 and verse 16. So, knowing the need for the people to have someone to lead, but not lead in the exact same way that Joshua and Moses did. It's a little different type of leader. It says, then the Lord raised up judges who saved them out of the hand of those who plundered them. Yet they did not listen to their judges, for they whored after other gods and bowed down to them. They soon turned aside from the way in which their fathers had walked, who had obeyed the commandments of the Lord, and they did not do so. So again, going back to verse 10 of chapter 2, Judges, he's saying what the outcome was. So God, seeing a need for some type of leadership, brings up these judges. And these judges are to, you know, the best example I can give is an elder, right? They're almost like elders function in the church. And they're to lead the people in that way. They're not a king. And we'll see later why. But they're almost like a shepherd, if you will. And yet, what happened? They didn't follow, right? And so what Joshua warned about is starting to come true. Go down to verse, we'll keep reading there in verse 18. It says, whenever the Lord raised up judges for them, the Lord was with the judge. And he saved them from the hand of their enemy all the days of the judge. For the Lord was moved to pity by their groaning because of those who afflicted and oppressed them. But whenever the judge died, what did they do? They turned back and were more corrupt than their fathers, going after other gods, serving them, bowing down to them. They did not drop any of their practices or stubborn ways. And so you have this cyclical problem going on. where you just have one generation coming up after another, all of them chasing after sin, and when they need God, they cry out for God, and they promise to come back, and I like what I was doing before. Once I get some relief from my problems, I'm going to go right back. It's the sin addiction problem. And they keep getting drawn back into it. And one of the kind of most emblematic and sad verses in Judges is in Judges 17 and verse 6. It really speaks to the problem that the people had. In those days, there was no king in Israel. Everyone did what was right in his own eyes. And that's really the problem, right? That they were led and guided by their own desire and lust for whatever it was. And so that's the cycle of Judges. We can go through the Judges, you can talk about them in detail, but really the overall scope is those issues of this cyclic sinfulness, get into trouble, well, God, I'm sorry, can you help me? And then go right back into it, right? And then it's just, and it was all because they weren't guided by God as they should have been. They were guided by their own lust and desire. And so that really leads us into their cry for a king. And that's in this next section. We'll go ahead and get started here. So Israel is really different than the other nations. Could you think about that just for a minute? What God is asking them to do is very different than most people live. Could you imagine the United States without the president? or England without a king, or they don't really prime minister, or you know, any nation surviving without some kind of formal head. That's really what they were, though, right? They didn't really have a king in an earthly sin, an earthly vessel. And so they were very different than the other nations. They weren't like Assyria. They weren't like Egypt. They weren't like any of those other people around them who had kings, right?
But wasn't God your king?
All right, don't get ahead of me. you're barking up the right tree. So they start looking around, and what's their response? Go to 1 Samuel 8, 1 through 3. It tells us that when Samuel became old. Now, the last two of the judges, of course, was Eli, who died in a kind of terrible way because he was his own problems, and his sons were evil. And then you have Samuel arise. It says, when Samuel became old, he made his sons judges over Israel. Samuel's actually not the last judge of Israel. We sometimes maybe consider that. He's not. His sons were actually. But there was a problem, wasn't there? The name of his firstborn son was Joel, and the name of his second was Abijah. They were judges in Beersheba. Yet his sons did not walk in his ways, but turned aside after gain. They took bribes and perverted justice. I mean, it was just a copy of what Eli and his sons had done. Right? Samuel was a better man than Eli, but the sons and the problem with the sons is the same. Now, just from a pragmatic standpoint, I can at least understand this about the nation of Israel. They look at those judges and they look at their sons and the corruption going on, and they start to wonder, is there not a better system than this? Now, they were looking in the wrong place. The problem was not the system, it was the men who were serving as judges, right? They needed to get their life right. But they start wondering, well, is there a better way? Verse 4, then all the elders of Israel gathered together and came to Samuel at Ramah and said to him, behold, you are old. That's a great way to start a conversation.
Facts are facts.
Brian, you're kind of old, right? But they say, you're old and your sons do not walk in your ways. Now appoint for us a king to judge us like all the nations. So, Sarai and Abram, you know, trying to look for an alternative to help God out. The elders of Israel are looking for a way to help God out. We need a king. We need to be like everybody else. Sometimes asking for what you don't have gets you into trouble. Sometimes you get exactly what you ask for, right? Grass is always greener on the other side until you get over there. Like, well, I didn't see all this other stuff over here. And so they come crying for a king. Point for us a king. And I'll go ahead and stop here because I'm out of time. But we'll continue on here. What's going to happen as a result of their cry? And before we do that, though, we'll look at, well, who was their king? Who was a king really? And have they misplaced their judgment? Have they judged wrongly? And so we'll talk about that next week. Thank you all so much. We'll continue this next week.